system isn't. You can track anyone that you want to under a lot of different circumstances. That's not private information. So what you do with it might violate law, but simply obtaining legally tracking information for a particular person, as far as I'm aware, is not intrinsically illegal.
WNWR.
Yes.
WNWR, Rob over here in Greenwich. Good evening, everyone, on this humid day, or evening. It can be. People have been caught putting tracking devices on their wife's car, the girlfriend's car, and it is counted as illegal to do that.
That's a different thing entirely. There's a difference between you placing a tracking device on a person and you utilizing tracking technology that is intrinsic in the devices that everyone walks around with. There are tracking devices, there are tracking capabilities built into cell phones and cell towers. And there are legal means to gain access to the tower's data flow on that subject. That's not the same thing as planting your own private tracking device on a person.
Yes, I know. I'm just saying that is illegal, though.
Yes, I agree with you. But in the subject that we're talking about a global device identifier that's embedded in everything, that's not a violation because a third person didn't plant it on them. They planted it on themselves, and they're just gaining access to it somehow through probably legal means, although I don't know how many different people know how to access that type of information. But I've known from reports that I've seen about cell towers and cell phones that it's not really that difficult to trace people using cell phones, and it's not illegal. I think it costs something like $10,000 or $20,000 to get a license to get access to the cell tower data, but it's legal. There's no particular non-legal limitations to accessing that information presently.
I don't understand something. A corporation is another body, but you are a body, and corporation is a body. The body. What you do illegal or corporation do illegal is the same story. The only thing is that responsible would be the principal of the corporation. A corporation puts a tracker, they're tracking your banking information, everything that you have, and not telling you about it. And then you need a situation where the information gets to you, and then you found that GDID was implemented in Windows 10 and 11. And then it's like, all of a sudden, you're saying to yourself, I could have used Linux system, but I didn't. Is that legal? Back to you.
I'm not sure what you're alluding to, what's legal. Again, there's no law against it. If there's no law against it, it can't be illegal. There's no kind of, if there's nothing on the books, then whatever it is illegal. That's not how law works.
No, I'm trying to simply understand the mechanism. I'm not saying that I'm right. What I'm saying is I'm trying to understand. You're buying a cat, but you actually discovered that you didn't buy the cat. You bought raccoon. And now you have no way to protest. You have a raccoon? You have a raccoon. You paid for the cat. Now you paid for the windows. And then you found that there was a raccoon inside of the windows. You didn't pay for the raccoon. And nobody told you that the raccoon is there. And a corporation is a legal person. Now, the corporation could do it, so individual could do it. But the individual will be put to jail for tracking, let's say, and corporation will not. Back to you.
Again, a corporation cannot plant a tracking device on you and track you. A corporation and a person and anything or anyone can utilize a device that you bought with your money that carries that tracking information, and the business offers legally access to the tracking information. Data brokers buy and sell information about every single one of us. I think at the very end of the Biden administration, they tried to do an executive order to get rid of data brokers, but as soon as the next guy came, he reversed it. And they're back in power. And not only that, but the data brokers are most likely involved in getting paid by us to take information off of the data broker's own list, only to return them back to the list in a month and charge you again a monthly fee to keep taking information off their own list. And we live in a day that it's not so much as you try to buy a cat and you get a skunk. It's that you try and buy a cat and you discover down the road that you didn't buy the cat, you simply bought a license to pet the cat.
Thank you very much for this explanation. Any other comment from the audience?
KD2VHD.
Yeah, Jim?
Thank you. Wesley, a thought. It doesn't explain everything, but it's a piece of the puzzle that we're speaking of, and I'm glad we're speaking of it. I think it's a good thing. In this country, supposedly, our laws are based on the Constitution, which is things having to do with rights fall mostly under the Bill of Rights, which are the first 10 amendments. And they are all what the government cannot do to the people. In other big countries in history, most of the laws have dealt with what the people are allowed to do or not do. It's a completely inverse circumstance. So coming from one and going to the other is confusing. And ours has not caught up with the realities of the times technologically, for sure. That needs to get better. I think it's rude, it's a better system. But it's not in good shape at the moment. Just some thoughts to mull over. It doesn't explain everything, but it's meant in a helpful way.
You're coming, Dr. Roy?
I pretty much said my piece. The Bill of Rights is a particularly interesting set of constitutional amendments. The past 50, 60 years has not been like that. And I mentioned before that the last time the government has taken a position in privacy issues was back in the 1980s about what you rent videotapes. So, unfortunately, the legislature's grasp on modern technology is not good. I still remember the vacant stares of 75, 80-year-old senators having some idiot to tell them about Web 3.0 and such. Those guys are con men, and our legislators are kind of aged out, technologically unknowing people. And so we don't have laws to address the last 50, 60 years of technological progress, and I don't see it suddenly getting fixed, unfortunately.
Hear, hear.
I mean, hopefully if we start to bring in legislatures that are a bit younger, we'll have people who understand modern technology a bit better. But there's always kind of other things going on in the legislature, lobbyists and all manner of things screwing everything up. So I'm not terribly optimistic in the short term.
Interesting. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for your opinion and helping me understand the subject better. The next one would be gold. Gold, like gold. So where did the gold actually came from? I'm not sure if you, Dr. Roy, you had the chance to read my email. But how much gold do we have on the planet Earth? Well, we could put the layer on the whole entire planet, 1.5 feet thick with gold. So where did the gold actually came from, Dr. Roy? Into a chip.
Well, we sort of have talked about this in the past when we were talking about the gravitational waves and the interferometer that was detecting the collision of neutron stars under intense collisions of large cosmic objects. The gravitational field produces a black hole often, and a lot of extraneous material where lighter elements fuse together to form heavier elements like gold. I think during one of those gravitational wave detections, it was detected a large collection of gold that spontaneously came into existence as a result of the collision. So basically, it's the collision of very heavy objects manifesting, massive explosions or the creation of black holes.
And how did that could cover entire Earth, including oceans, with 1.5 feet thick layer, came to the Earth?
Well, again, because a lot of different things coalesced in the early creation of the solar system, and the gravitational field attracted them all. And, the same way that there's silicon, the same way that there's lead, the same way that there's uranium, the same way that there's thorium, etc. It's kind of dubious to explain the amount of gold that the Earth has, because a significant portion of it is deep near the core, and our technology has no clue how to get at it, and probably won't for the foreseeable future. So, if you had an entire core full of gold, it would be meaningless because you couldn't get to it.
So the conclusion is that the gold is extraterrestrial. Couldn't be produced by solar system, by sun, is extraterrestrial. So then we have certain collisions and explosions that happened in the past. And if Paul didn't mind to say a few words, don't mind to say a few words about those collisions that had happened in the history of the Earth, I would appreciate that. I know that 3.5 billion years ago, there was one, and that was, we assume, but we don't know, that one that had that put most of the gold into the air, but we don't know that. And then we had plenty of others, and eventually the recent one that didn't have a gold, but also there was a collision. Paul, do you mind to comment on it?
Standby. Little trouble with my mic again. Anyway, I watched the video that you sent all about the gold, and it goes back to a lot of the early readings that I spent decades ago, reading about where different metals and different elements come from. And you take, like, the sun. Sun can take hydrogen and turn it to helium, but eventually, when different suns, up to, I think, eight times the size of our, or eight times the mass of our sun could produce, I think that could produce different elements up to carbon. And then after that, then you have to get involved in other systems like supernova going off, and you know, would that be enough to produce the gold? I always thought that would probably be enough. But according to that video, it looks like they're talking about neutron stars would have to collide to create gold. So their theory is that gold is flying around the universe before our solar system was created, which was, what, 4.5 billion years ago. So they're saying the gold is quite old. So, yeah, that goes for a lot of the heavy elements, too. You know, the gold isn't the only heavy element. So that all that stuff had to be created before our solar system was ever started. I'd be interested in the spacecraft Psyche when it gets out to the asteroid of the same name, Psyche, which is a solid core. They expect it to be all metal, you know, different kinds of metals. I wonder if there's any gold inside of Psyche, and they'll find that out once that gigantic spacecraft eventually gets out there. Back to US, WS to us.
So, I understood that we had two major collisions 4.5 billion years ago. That was the planet that is about the size of Mars that collided with Earth, and a part of that created Moon, and that's why we have a Moon. Didn't have enough of energy for the Moon, for this part, to go out. Then 3.5 billion years ago, we had another one. And that was by asteroid. That was about 12 to 19 miles across. And that one struck the Earth, unleashing catastrophic global consequences. Mega tsunamis, continent shaking, earthquakes, evaporation, frack. And this one was supposedly the one that brought most of the gold to the Earth, but we don't know for sure. There's no evidence that it was this way. But then we have 66 million years ago, and that was another one. That was the one that wiped out dinosaurs 66 million years ago. But then we go to the recent one. We have, if I'm not mistaken, that was Chicxulub. I'm not sure how to pronounce it properly. That was in Yucatan Peninsula of Southeast Mexico. That one was approximately 10 to 15 kilometers, which is 6 to 9 miles in diameter. And the force was about 100 teratons of TNT, or a billion times of the power of Hiroshima bomb. And that one caused a tsunami and eventually put the Earth to the stage where small creatures from mammals group were able to survive, and that's why we have a human being. But then we have Tunguska. It was in 1900 something, but I'm not sure. 1900 something, that was Tunguska meteor. And then another one was in 2013, that was in Russia, somewhere, the small one. If you don't mind to comment on it, Paul, please.
Remember that was 2008. So, and then the Russian one was, that's the one that, that's modern times where all the glass and everything broke. What was the name of that town? Began with a C. Anyway, yeah, but gold was not created by any of those impacts.
Yeah, gold was not created by any one of those. I assume, but from the physics standpoint, Dr. Roy may correct me. I assume gold is heavy. So in the process of creation of the Earth, most of that gold was sucked into the center of the Earth. Right or wrong, Roy, back to you.
I wouldn't exactly call it sucked, but density, buoyancy, all those wonderful things. Heavy stuff sinks, goes to the bottom, and lower density things rise to the top.
Okay, so the reason that we have no access to the, to all of the gold is because we have no technology that allow us to just reach there. I know that there was a try, Russian try in the 60s. They went quite deep, about 3 miles deep into the Earth. I'm not sure. Paul, do you recall that?
Not sure which one. I know about Meteor Crater, that's the one out in Arizona, but I don't know about one that went 3 miles into the Earth. Meteor Crater is that deep. Back to you, Wes.
By the way, the Earth's, the diameter of the Earth is about 8,000 miles, so you can imagine what 3 miles is to 8,000. So it just kind of scratched the crust. It didn't go very deep.
Yeah, that was, I found it. The Soviet Union drilled to the Earth's core. They dug the, and it wasn't really, that was 40,230 feet, 1989, which penetrates about the third way to the Baltic continental crust. And less than 0.1% of the distance to the center. So, you're absolutely right. Back to you, Dr. Ray.
No, I just wanted to state the obvious. We don't have the technology, and probably it's for a good thing because the core is high pressure and high heat. You know, volcanoes are just little cracks in the crust. So you can imagine what you'd end up having to deal with if you were able to punch a hole all the way into the core.
Right. And to HCN, we may also think about 13.8 billion years since the Big Bang. And then think that the last 200 years. Maybe 250 years is all what pushed humanity to where we are now. Back to you, Dr. Ray.
Yeah. But who knows how long we have to go? Because we have no idea how sentient life persists. It could be that sentient life is ultimately self-limiting.
Paul, do you have a comment on it?
I don't, Wes. No further comments.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate the time given to me. Back to the net control and to HCM.
Okay, very good. Wesley, thank you for your participation as always. This is AC2GS, and this is the Limark Technical Net, and it's 9:28. We got lots of free time if people want to use it, or if you want to have this be an early technical net, it's up to you guys. I just run it, but you people determine what direction we tend to go. So if anyone has any questions or comments or topics that they would like to discuss here on the Technical Net, please hit that push to talk and say your piece.
KD2VHD, I'll fill the space if you're okay with it.
Okay, you know, as long as it's legitimate, I don't have a problem.
Wesley had an interesting thought about the last 250 years, which are very interesting. But they're such a small piece of a big puzzle of things. And then, for example, the gold thing. If we have 100 trillion tons of gold and it's worth $1 bazillion, and we were to dig down to the bottom of the hole and pull up another 100 trillion or 200 trillion or 300 trillion pounds of gold, and they'd be worth the same as what we got already. It's all based on scarcity. You mess up scarcity and it messes up the whole thing. That's a ridiculously oversimplification of the concept, I recognize. But for the sake of this net, that'll do.
I agree with the concept, but not the way you arrange the words. The value of available gold would not stay the same. They'd go down. Matter of fact, you could see historical demonstration of that. When the Spanish invaded the Americas and stole all the gold from them, they bankrupted anyone who had gold because the price plummeted because it wasn't scarce anymore for a while until things equilibrated.
Well, if I flub my presentation, I'm sorry, but that was exactly the point I was trying to make, so thank you.
No problem. Any other comments? Jim, did you say your piece at that point?
I lost my train of thought, but I have a space question, but I'll leave that to whenever it's appropriate.
Okay, yeah, you could leave it to Paul. He'll be doing the SpaceNet report tonight.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Just comments about taking the letter S off of the different URLs. That works very good. I tried them all. So no problem with that. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, the S means security. It's a secure protocol that requires encryption. It's a more sophisticated thing that my website, unfortunately, doesn't have a secure layer code. So if you try to get into the place using a web browser that automatically adds the HTTPS to it, it won't allow it because it's not a secure website. So, you know, removing the S means that it's just the standard lower security HTTP protocol, and it goes right through. Unfortunately, modern-day browsers tend to affix HTTPS to everything that you don't already put it in.
No, no problem, yeah. Days ago, I was talking to a ham out in California, and he was interested in what's the TechNet, what's the SpaceNet report. So I told him the website, this before I knew you had the problem, and he said it's not coming up. So I tried it, and the same thing happened. So next time I speak to him, I'll let him know the secret to get rid of that S.
Okay, very good. I'm sorry that it happened. I don't exactly know what triggered it because I've been using the same setup for years. The only thing changed is one of the entries I had to modify because of my new router wouldn't accept that port. But there were others that I didn't change at all, but since I changed one, apparently it kind of rewrote its commands to append the HTTPS at the front of the browsers for all of them. So, you know, unfortunately, we're kind of stuck with it for the time being. I have no way of making it a secure website that will accept HTTPS at this point. So, you know, it doesn't seem to be dissuading too many people. We have a whole page full of people listening to the audio stream, about 8 or so people. So they didn't get blocked from it. They figured their way around it. So it looks like it'll work out in the long run.
Yeah, very good. Yeah. They should just leave well enough alone, all these different things. YouTube the other day. I always went to YouTube and clicked on guests, you know. And then you watch, if you want to watch a movie or something. But now that doesn't work anymore. Now that's out. Now they want your whole life history, I guess, you know. Email and all. They everybody keeps fooling with things. Just leave well enough alone.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's not how these guys play. They kind of make things worse and worse and worse over time. It would be perfect if you can kind of freeze everything. Google search used to be much better before they fixed it. Unfortunately, engineers sometimes don't know what fixing things entails, so they simply make things worse and worse. I mean, there's a rationale for the security issues. You know, it's always good to kind of force people to use more secure websites. But, I mean, if your system can't accept it, it can't accept it. So, you know, there's the difference between kind of prodding people to do the right thing and forcing people to do things they can't do, because it would be nice if you could.
Okay, yeah. Things like that, you know. I just bought another watch, you know, cheap watch, you know. It's not one of these expensive Apple watches. It's just a cheap one, but it's very good, you know. I mean, if I get a text on my phone, it pops up on my watch, no problem. But you know, they're doing better. Bluetooth works better. Years ago, I used to have nothing but trouble with Bluetooth. But now I don't have a problem. So sometimes they go in the right direction, but other times, like, you know, they upgrade your, they'll send a signal to your phone to upgrade it. And all of a sudden, you know, some of the apps don't work anymore. You know, you have to go back and things, you know, just leave it alone. Was it broken? Why? What are you sending signals for to change things? You know, but if they're making changes, it's usually not for the customer. It's usually for them.
Comment.
Yes, Jim.
I love that. Google was much better before they fixed it. I think that's a T-shirt slogan. Google was much better before they fixed it. AC2GS. Sure, complete. I love it. Good job.
You're welcome. It's not a novel concept. I've heard people complain for years and years and years. They succumb to the allure of advertising money. They make massive quantities. And so if you kind of do a Google search for some brand, you're guaranteed that the first item is going to be one of their competitors. That pays them ad money to do just that. It's the nature. Everyone's trying to maximize their profitability. That's how these stock prices keep going up and up and up, and they'll squeeze every last penny out of it. So, and we have to live through this nonsense. You know, unless you're the guy who buys the stocks, I guess.
You crystallized it quite well, though. I kind of give you a thumbs up on that.
Okie doke. Glad to be excited.
Can I go back to the article for a moment?
Say again?
Can I go back to the technical conversation for one moment?
Certainly.
Have you ever heard of a WAGU connection, W-A-G-O, WAGU, an electrical connector? It comes from Europe. It's getting very popular in the United States, mostly for electrical, like home electrical service and whatnot. But I think it has a tremendous useful in the ham radio world. Have you ever heard of it or seen such a thing?
Not only that, but I own some. I own a box of those things. I saw them once on Amazon and was fascinated by it.
Me too. I use them for a number of things. And I think as long as you don't get the perception that they're permanent in the outdoors, they're a great way to fiddle around with ham radio antennas. Like, they like put PVC pipe to the plumbing versus the old lead and oakum joints. Regular people can put antennas together.
Oh, okay. I never thought of them for that purpose. I use them inside my my switch boxes in my house. They don't strike me as particularly, you kind of inferred it, weatherproof.
No, they are not weatherproof in any means. But I think if you were to put them on a soldered piece of copper stranded wire and put them on, you can use them through some storms. They would work just fine. But the point is you can put together something now. You can adjust it now. You can shorten it and lengthen it now. You can regular people can actually put things together now. I think they should be a boon to the ham radio world. Eventually you got to solder it or something, but it lets you experiment with lengths and configurations far easier than other options we've had in the past.
Okay, I never considered them for that. I just hate screw nuts, and this is the best solution I've found to screw nuts.
Agreed. The wire nut done properly, which nobody ever does it, including the professionals, technically can carry more, but it's never done right, and the WAGU is hard to do wrong.
Yep, I'm surprised it's not as popular as it should be. It should have, done the end of the wire nuts, but a lot of people don't know them. I kind of like to peruse through Amazon. I discover all kinds of interesting things that way.
Certainly is that. But I think for antennas, they have wide application for experimentation, I suppose, is the right word for this form and this topic. They're just so much easier than other ways of putting something together ad hoc.
Okay, I'll keep it in mind. Like I said, I have a box of them.
Spread the word and thank you. KD2VHD.
You're welcome. This morning I was on my weekly 10-meter net, and a gentleman from the West Coast asked me if I come from Jersey.
I can top that.
Okay.
In about 1980, me and my bunch of classmates took a trip to the Grand Canyon, and as the bus stopped, the last gas station stopped before the desert crossing we had to do before we went to Grand Canyon. We went to the little shop, to the gas station, get something to drink, snack. And the person at the counter asked us if we were from Boston. And I sound distinctly Brooklyn. I was born there. I don't know why I still have that accent. I left Brooklyn at 2. Went back as a professional many years later, but she thought we were from Boston. We could not understand it. How could you possibly confuse a Brooklynite to a Bostonian? Yet, that's the case.
Yeah, well, there's more than a few people who get their accents wrong.
I'll leave that at that.
Okie doke. Once again, this continues to be AC2GS, and this continues to be the Limark Technical Med. We're still open for business, 9:44 apparently, according to my clocks. And so we have a good half hour if you want to use it. So again, it's all up to you guys. If you got a subject, if you got a question, if you got a topic, if you some kind of thought that's badgering you and you want to kind of roll it around here on the technical net, now is a wonderful opportunity just to hit that button and say your piece.
I'll take the mic if it's open.
Sure.
You mentioned something earlier about 5/8 wave antennas that I sounded contrary to what I had learned recently, and I have no basis for expertise on this. It's what I was happened to be reading about, and I'm curious if you could clarify. So it was my understanding that because a 5/8 wave has more current higher up on its radiating element, that it tended to have a more horizontal radiation pattern and not good for a skip for bouncing off the ionosphere. It was better for ground wave. That seemed to contradict what you said earlier. Did I misunderstand you, or am I misunderstanding the concept, or can you speak to that some more?
Well, because the current is offset upward, the takeoff angle is also offset upward. So it has a steeper takeoff angle, which allows it to kind of clear nearby local elevations. It's not particularly great as a ground wave propagating radiator. It's more capable of handling sky wave. I use it on my 10 meters net, and when there was propagation, you know, I got a lot of distance. So it works for me, and I think if you peruse the general literature, it'll say that it has a higher takeoff angle than, say, a quarter wave vertical has, which is kind of the typical vertical antenna.
Yeah, my interpretation when I was reading said the opposite, but I was looking specifically about 6 meter stuff, so there may be a difference there. And the difference between local comms and DX. I'll have to study it some more. I don't fully understand the concept. I do understand that it's worth learning.
Yes, it is certainly worth learning.
Hopping to another random point, seems, being that I have the space. If I understand it, and you've been playing this game a lot longer than I have, Roy, 6 meter mobile used to be a big thing in these parts, maybe in all parts, and for medium range communication. And it's unheard of now. Everybody talks of the magic band and the O band openings, and you can do DX on 6 meter. Nobody talks about local communications on pretty much simplex 6 meters. Any comments on that?
Well, it's like all things. There's a time and a place. Some things become very popular, and then they become abandoned. Repeaters were incredibly popular, especially during the auto patch years of making phone calls. And now there's a lot of them that sit there quiet and silent. So unfortunately, there's been a lot of decrease in general activity. And that affects the less generally popular bands, like 6 meters. It only works well during the sunspot active times, and even those are kind of problematic during our recent spring and summers. So it's just a matter of people have, you know, less people are active on all bands. So 6 meters is less populated generally. So it got hit even more than the other bands. So it's just, you know, things like that. There's a few people who love it and still use it. There's a lot of people who don't even bother to get an antenna that's resonant for it.
I guess I'm approaching you from a different perspective, in that most people seem to count it as being that it works only when the bands favor it. But I would take it from the perspective of it works on DX only when the bands favor it. And that in some cases, for regional, local, let's say Brooklyn to Suffolk, works better when it's not open, perhaps. And there's each has its benefit, but I think neither one is better than the other. They're just different.
Well, I don't think a lot of people think of it as a great frequency to work ground waves. Its benefit is, you know, during the sunspot maximum, it's kind of known as the magic band because it's capable of you know, wrapping around the ionosphere and going all over the place. That's where the great, you know, sunspot fish stories come through 6 meters. You know, if you just want to talk locally, it's probably easier to use the more convenient bands that are much more active. You know, I assume if you work it regularly, you'll find other people that work it regularly, but there's a lot more people on, you know, 17 and 15 and lower HF frequencies than 6 meters to just work ground wave.
WNWR.
Yes, Rob.
Yeah, the 6 meter, the mystery band or the magic band. I don't have a 6 meter antenna out here, but I made a dipole out of copper tubing. It's about 5 feet long with a coil and adjusted. But a friend of mine calls me up. He goes, 6 meters wide open. By the time I run the cable out there and put it up on the tripod and the extended pole, the band's gone. But follow solar flares. If you turn around and find out, well, we had a solar flare, 40 meters is dead, run to 6 meters.
Okay, but as you mentioned, a lot of us simply don't have anything that really is resonant on 6 meters because it's so far and few and far between of any benefit.
I disagree conceptually.
Okay.
I think if you view the question through DX contacts, you're completely right. I have no argument. But I remember back in my early days in the fire service, in the late 70s, early 80s, out on the suburbs of Long Island, most of this stuff was happening at 50 megahertz, and there was solid communications, simplex between places that you would not believe, and it's not the X, it's a different mode. It doesn't do what a repeater does, but it gets you in touch with your extended neighborhood very reliably in the frequencies that were near 6 meters, and I assume 6 meters works similarly. If I'm wrong, say so.
Now, there's guys I know up in Hopewell Junction in the area nightly have 6 meter conversations there. Guy upstate Connecticut, up in Middlefield, Connecticut, they get on nightly and have 6 meter contacts.
Okay, but it seems to be a more of a regional favorite than a general favorite.
Yeah, if you're going to do DX, I wasn't much of a 6 meter contact.
Poland regional.
Radio Oasis used to be up in Louisville, George, and to, I forget his name, he passed away there. And I got a 6 meter hamstack. We tuned it all up, and on my way down to 84 and 684 there, I worked at 6 meter, I forget, local here. And then I, you know, in North Carolina with the dipole out there when I got it out there, but no real DXing, you know. Probably vertical or something would probably be better, or beam, but I'm not too much on there. I got stuff I can tune it up, but then again, that's like how many people have an 80-meter and 160 antenna there. You know, your 20-meter, 40-meter antenna because it's smaller property. So it's the activity and, you know, how much people really want to get into it, WNWR.
Yeah, I agree with you. It really is a local phenomenon. There are modes that are popular in one area of the country that are totally non-used in other portions. So you either have to adjust to your community or try and be a revolutionary.
Understood. It seems to be what you guys are saying. It seems to fit with my observation. But I think it seems to fill a hole that that the rest of the system, I don't know if that's the right word, doesn't address something that's not quite your neighbor and not quite your, you know, the other side of the world, but it's much more intimate.
WNWR. Okay. Take for instance, contesters. A lot of these contesters, you don't hear them any other time on the radio until a contest is on, and they come out of the woodwork. So it's kind of like that, you know. Some people just do 6 meters. That's all they do. Some just do simplex, 2 meters, or, you know, different modes are at different times. I'm fortunate. I have a 180-meter antenna, which is 132-foot from one end to the other, fed with all balance line, balance tuner, no ballon, no onions, no coils, no nothing. And if you look at my QRZ page on W1WR, you see a coil box. That coil box with nice switches, that takes that 132-foot dipole and switches it to 160, and I do great on it. Now that's, I'm in a squashed-in yard, but I found a way to do it.
Did you say you got it on 180?
I have an 132-foot balanced dipole that I work 80 meters and everything else there. I throw the coils, the switches into that coils box that you'll see on my QRZ page, and that puts me on 160 meters.
Nice.
And that was a coil box that a lot of people said that wouldn't even work, and it does.
Okay, very good. Any other comments out there?
I was taught in my early time, I've been only ham radio operator since 2007. But fortunately, I have somebody from a broadcasting engineer that's very good. Never went to school. Just learned how to do electronics by picking televisions off the corners of things there. And he tunes up broadcasting stations here and takes care of an AM radio station and an FM one. And the things that he knows and showed me to do. But a lot of people say, the antenna book. And I was taught, the antenna book is only a guideline. And my father taught me in the machine shop, if you don't look outside the box, you won't venture anyplace else.
Yeah, but unfortunately, some people famous for looking outside of the box, the chess master, someone kind of made a comment about him that he thought outside of the box and then he got stuck out there.
K2R1.
Yes, David?
Well, I think, you know, you get the basic knowledge of what is known and books and things like that. You gain the knowledge that you have to start to think with your brain, and you have to do it on your own.
Well, again, we've kind of had this conversation before. Both of them are necessary. It's always good to have a good foundation of knowledge, and then to have experiences that shape and mold your understanding and broaden your appreciation for things. Too much of one without the other kind of leaves you a little bit less full on the subject than you can from both.
Well, that's true. I think that people have to be aware of the source of this information, this knowledge, whether it's good, whether it's valid, whether it's ethical, whether it's useful or valuable, you know?
Yeah,
I have a relevant question.
Sure.
I think it's a great topic we're talking about. I'll frame the question like this. As you grow up from a little tyke, is it better that you learn Newton's law of gravity and equations about the, you know, terminal velocity and the like, or first? Or is it better that you learn don't drop the hammer on your thumb because it's going to hurt? First, and it sounds like an easy question, but consider it. And just because I propose that a little kid is learning it, I'm applying it to all people. And it sounds like a simpleton question, but I don't think it is.
I would tend to think that learning the practical information first is the best approach. As long as you continue on the, in the path.
Comment?
Sure.
You know what, I never bought what they call a fag antenna. From day one, I built my own antenna. Had a Johnson Viken matchbox. And I made a long wire. Not an headset, a long wire. I took my Elmer, an on-the-retainer electronic technician. He took that Johnson matchbox and put it at the window down here in the basement, against the window, not at my desk, by the radio, and took it and made a long wire, 125 feet of wire, 15 feet of it went up to the 20-foot pole there, and then to the 120 feet, directly in there, and then a ground wire with a ground spike in there, and then I ran the coax here. I said, why? He says, because if you brought that matchbox and that wire here, that single wire, you're going to have RF all over the place. This way, the RF is outside. And people couldn't understand that. And I've worked the entire world on my FT2000D at 180 watts. Worked the entire world on that piece of wire for many years, homebrew. But, like I said, some people didn't understand. And these are the guys have been ham radios for how many years? And I learned right from the beginning, build my own antenna. And I try to stress that to new hams. First start on the outside and build your own antenna. It's not that hard. It's easy. It can be done. A dipole, a long wire, end fed, whatever you want. I said, get yourself an antenna analyzer. It worked from the outside in. And I hear so many guys that I got the biggest radio and amplifier, and their antenna is, can I say the word, crap.
Well, that's been known to happen a lot. But yeah, it makes sense to me. I mean, the whole point is you want it shielded in your shack. You don't want unshielded wire. It's going through common mode. It doesn't know when to stop radiating. So yeah, you want it as close to the outdoors as you can. You can't slide it into the outdoors because your antenna tuner would get water and be wrecked. So I don't know. Makes sense to me.
100 watts in a wire.
Well, I've been running this since 2007, and I've been using balance line, open balance line, and I built my own open wire. Actually, a lot of AMers, which I am, use a 600 ohm with 4-inch spacers, but I can't do that here. I have a lot of electrical and BX air in the ceiling, and I got to keep it a certain amount of feet away from it. So I took the spacers, the 4-inch spacers, which are by Fishox electric fence insulators, took them out in my shop, cut them exactly 2-inch, and made 450 ohm ladder line, open ladder lines. Much better than the crappy brown stuff. Now you can't get the crappy brown stuff in 14 gauge. They're not even making it anymore. And it's not affected by the rain anymore, and my tuning is much better. And I'm using the vintage Johnson Kilowatt Matchbox. To this day, that is, to me, is gold. And it's very special to me that because that was in the N1DCG 95th anniversary, the first shortwave transmission from Greenwich, Connecticut, right up the street from me, with, what's his name there, FM there. He was here. Paul Godley, who went over to England originally, then over to Scotland because the weather was on. And that Johnson matchbox was matched up with Joe Walsh's Johnson Viking, Johnson Valiant, and his and my NC, my tuner, and my dipole. So that Johnson my matchbox is still the king.
Ah, good to hear. Yeah, they don't make them like this anymore. The parallel Pi networks work